May it please the court, Mr. Bruce. Appellant urges this court to never reach our Sixth Amendment challenge to the direct connection rule under the by finding that the evidence against Donald Nash is insufficient to sustain a conviction under either the pre-State v. Grimm circumstantial evidence rule or under the standard of review that now exists as to the sufficiency of the evidence. In some ways, the most important case, in our view, is State v. Freeman, which came out of this court just a couple of years ago. The state has urged in its brief that the circumstantial evidence in this case, and there is nothing but circumstantial evidence in this case, despite the state's bald assertion to the contrary, the state suggests that the circumstantial evidence in this case is more compelling than was the circumstantial evidence in State v. Freeman, but it's simply not true. This court reversed the Southern District Court of Appeals in Freeman because the Southern District had applied the pre-Grimm standard of review to a post-Grimm crime. In Freeman, and these are both DNA cases, in Freeman, the defendant's DNA was on the victim's stockings, including the one that was wrapped around her neck. She died by strangulation. The problem with the defendant's theory in Freeman about that evidence and how his DNA could have come to be on her stockings is that she wore pants over her stockings when she and the defendant, Mr. Freeman, were together drinking earlier that night. His DNA could not have come innocently to be on her stockings.
It was also found on toilet paper that was in her home.
More to the point, yes. Toilet paper that matched the toilet paper in her home is found under her body in her home at the site of her death and bearing Mr. Freeman's DNA. Her physical injuries were consistent with a Galliano bottle that Mr. Freeman had insisted on taking from the tavern as a souvenir. He matched, Mr. Freeman did, the general physical description of the man seen entering into the victim's apartment shortly before the victim in Mr. Freeman's case was murdered. And in Freeman, the accused had an opportunity and a means to commit the murder. Doc Nash didn't have the opportunity. Doc Nash didn't have the means. She was shot with a shotgun, Judy Spencer was, but there is no shotgun. There was never even a witness that said Doc Nash has ever in his life owned a shotgun or even looked at a shotgun. Here, no reasonable juror could infer from the state's evidence that Donald R. Nash caused the death of Judy Spencer.
You're referring, of course, to the is it disputed or not disputed that the DNA of both the victim and the and Mr. Nash could be under her fingernails in because of their relationship and having nothing to do with whether or not he was the person who committed the crime.
That was the uncontroverted evidence, and it came from our own expert as well as from the state's expert, who was the lab supervisor of the other state's expert.
So that was sort of an equipoise. The DNA didn't do anything other than the fact that it confirmed that they had a relationship.
67% of cohabitors have one another's DNA underneath their fingernails.
What about the washing of the hair? Wasn't there disputed evidence that because she washed her hair after she saw him
last? She did
something.
The word wash was used. Whether shampoo was involved is not clear from the record. Whether it's a soap-based shampoo or a detergent-based shampoo is not known in the record. And the state's expert said that those types of shampoos make a difference. And there were introduced two uncontroverted studies showing, to the surprise of some, that repeated hand washings will not remove DNA from under one's fingernails, even when you're a male nurse in a hospital, repeatedly scrubbing your hands in the way that doctors and nurses do inside of a hospital for 2 weeks.
I'm just asking, isn't that a disputed fact, not an undisputed fact?
There is a dispute about the extent of the hair washing. Yes, sir.
And whether or not the DNA could or could not have been.
I don't think that that's a disputed fact anymore.
Well, it is disputed whether there was so much DNA that it can't just be a trace amount that would be left, but that it had to have been acquired under her fingernail after she washed her hair and shortly before her death.
No, there was no evidence to that effect. The state argued it, but there was no evidence to that effect. The evidence was that repeated bathings, repeated hand washings, washing dishes.
What was the evidence about? What was the nature of the DNA under the nails?
There was a mixture of Judy Spencer's DNA and Doc Nash's DNA. There was a dispute between the two experts as to whether or not the same quantity or a like quantity of Mr. Nash's DNA was present in a similar quantity to Judy Spencer's own DNA. It's undisputed that there was a mixture of both DNAs, whether they were in similar quantities was disputed, but we submit it doesn't matter, because the presence of his DNA there was simply an artifact of their cohabitation.
But regardless of that, it's your position that even assuming that was some evidence, it's insufficient to arise to the evidence necessary to show something by beyond a reasonable doubt, or at best it has equally valid inferences arising from it?
I'm coming to that. Okay. I'm suggesting in the first half of my argument about sufficiency of the evidence is that under the post-Grimm standard of review, beyond a reasonable doubt, the state failed to meet its burden. But the state can't avoid what it's admitted in its own brief.
There was other evidence of their relationship and his making statements threatening her earlier in the evening and so forth, was there not?
There was attributed to him a statement, "That's the last time you'll lie to me." There's a dispute as to whether or not the word bitch occurred next in that sentence. There is disagreement whether or not that amounted to a threat, because she went home to Doc immediately after he supposedly said that to her. She went home and changed clothes and said she was going out for the night. They argued about her resumption of drinking, and he never saw her again, although he looked for her for hours that night and the next day. Now, under the pre-Grimm standard of review, which this court must apply, the state is urging this court to commit an ex post facto violation. But if this court applies the pre-Grimm standard of review, part and parcel of the old circumstantial evidence rule is the equally valid inferences rule. And under the equally valid inferences rule, which this court must apply to analyze this case, it is at least equally valid to infer that Doc's DNA was under Judy Spencer's fingernails from a perfectly innocent cause, the fact of their mere cohabitation. And because that is at least an equally valid inference, there is insufficient evidence to convict under either the pre-Grimm or the post-Grimm standards of review.
Can you address your constitutional argument that we're required to apply the equally valid inferences, the pre-Grimm circumstantial evidence rule?
Yes. An ex post facto law is defined in four ways. The one that's pertinent to this case is the fourth definition in Calder versus Bull from 1798, very shortly after the Constitution was adopted. And that is an alteration of the legal rules of evidence to permit the conviction of a crime based upon less or different evidence than the law required at the time of the alleged crime. This court was very careful in Grimm, and again in Cheney and Freeman. This court was very careful to explain its reasoning that the U.S. Constitution requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This court very carefully wrote in Grimm that the state of Missouri does not need to impose a higher standard of proof in circumstantial evidence cases, does not need to require more evidence in circumstantial evidence cases, but had done so up until 1993, when Grimm was decided. Grimm did away with that higher burden on the state. Grimm did away with the requirement of more proof in a circumstantial evidence case. There can be no question that the circumstantial evidence rule, that the elimination of the circumstantial evidence rule was to do exactly what the fourth category of ex post facto laws cited in Calder versus Bull and Carmel versus Texas describe, permitting a conviction on less evidence than the law required at the time of the alleged crime. Our suggestion is this court must apply the circumstantial evidence rule and must apply the equally valid inferences rule and find Mr. Nash not guilty. Our position is, even if the court disagrees and believes that it is not an ex post facto problem to apply the post-Grimm standard of review, that the evidence is nonetheless insufficient to sustain a conviction. Now, the state admits that because this was a 1982 homicide, the current section 565.001.2 requires the application of 1982 laws to the charging and trial of that 1982 crime. But that's not how the case was tried. The case was tried under 1984 and 2009 law. The case was tried under post-Grimm law. Instead of, moreover, Your Honors, the state fails to acknowledge that the plain language of Section 565.001.2 requires not only that the case be charged and tried according to the surviving laws from 1982, but it must be reviewed on appeal in the same way. The ex post facto clause of the U.S. Constitution, the ex post facto clause of the Missouri Constitution, and the plain language of Section 565.001.2 require it, and that's not what was done. The state's response to our ex post facto argument has been to argue in return that the error was not preserved, number one, and number two, that there really was no ex post facto problem because there was no reduction in the quantum of evidence. And I've addressed the second of those two.
Counsel, your time has expired.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court. With regard to the circumstantial evidence instruction in this case, this court's already decided that issue in State versus Grimm. This court said, State versus Grimm, that the instruction was both misleading and confusing. And what the defendant is arguing is that this court should mandate that the trial court have given a bad instruction, bad law. Now, this court said in State versus Jamie Avery just almost 2 years ago exactly, there can be no error in giving good law to the jury. I think a corollary to that is there can be no error in failing to give bad law to the jury. And I want to make one thing clear that I don't think was made clear in Appellant's brief, his argument that this is ex post facto. And first of all, that was not raised to the trial court either. It made a constitutional objection, and that's basically the word he used, but the court really wasn't given the opportunity to address the issue, the trial court, and it's not fair to the trial court to come in to the appellate court.
Well, you said it was raised below, but he couldn't.
No, it wasn't raised below.
Okay.
No, there was no
the
argument.
The words ex post facto were not used below?
There was no argument, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's no argument that the failure to give the circumstantial evidence rule was a violation of the ex post facto provisions of the Constitution. But more basic than that, what this court said back in 1993 in Grimm was that the circumstantial evidence rule originally was a higher standard. And it originally was a higher standard, but this court said as it went through the history, but it has been tempered over the years. And by the time we get at least to 1976, prior to this murder in 1982, the circumstantial evidence rule was no different. And in fact, in lastly, in the 1979 case by this court, and lastly, this court explicitly said that it is not a different standard. It is not a different rule.
Well, and what if we thought it was different? Would that then be unconstitutional for us to not apply it to a pre-Grimm decision?
It would then depend on whether or not, I believe the language that the United States Supreme Court used in Bowie versus City of Columbia in 1964 was whether it was unanticipated and, I'm sorry, the words escape me, but basically that it had to be a shock, a surprise to in a situation in which the court, as opposed to the legislature, we know the legislature can't do it, but in a case where the court does it, in Bowie in 1964, the Supreme Court said, well, it would have to be a situation where it was unexpected. Well, we've got lastly in 1979, where this court has said the only reason we're not doing away with circumstantial evidence rule was because we don't have a reasonable doubt instruction. Well, prior to this trial, this court established in 1984 a reasonable doubt instruction. Reasonable doubt instruction was given in this case. There's no argument by the defendant, by the appellant, that instruction, giving that instruction was error. And this court, again, in Grimm said, we believe the reasonable doubt instruction fully and accurately instructs the jury on the risk of non-persuasion. So again, it is an issue that has been decided. The other thing that makes this case a little bit hard, I think, to review is the fact that the instruction, the proposed instruction that Mr. Nash says he wanted to submit isn't in the record. I didn't realize, I was looking through it. What he did attach to his brief was a copy of the 1979 circumstantial evidence instruction. That instruction is inconsistent with what he argues in his brief. In his brief, he argues that the standard is that the evidence has to be irreconcilable. That's even in 1979. In 1976, that was not the standard. So he's arguing a standard that didn't even exist at the time of this murder. So it is not a different standard. And as I said, and lastly, this court explicitly said it's not a higher burden. The circumstantial evidence rule is not a different burden. With regard to the statute, and maybe the court's not concerned about, but Mr. Nash made the argument that 565.001 also mandates that you give the circumstantial evidence instruction. And again, I don't think that this court believes, and anybody believes, that the legislature could mandate that a bad instruction had to be given. It's also important, I think, to note what that statute actually says. And it says that what it actually says is that in prior cases, we will pretend like this statute, this chapter doesn't exist. Okay. It doesn't say we have to do things the way they've done in the past. What it says is we have to do things the way that they were done in the past. In other words, this court has the authority to change the instructions. This court changes the instructions. There's nothing about 565.001 that says things have to stay the way they were in 1984 or 1983 or 1982. With regard to the strength of the evidence, I know Mr. Nash has said repeatedly that it's undisputed that the evidence was that the DNA was by casual contact. I think I'm confident the court's read the record that it was a matter of dispute, clear dispute. Even the scientific articles were disputed. What we learned was that those scientific studies did not in fact determine whether or not hand washing had any impact on it. It talked about hand washing habits, but it didn't talk about hand washing. And his expert was cross-examined about that, and she had admitted that wasn't there. That was a jury issue to decide whether or not, and that's kind of part of the confusion, I think, about the circumstantial evidence rule. Circumstantial evidence rule still didn't do away with the standard of review by this court under Delaney, which is that we assume all facts and circumstances from the evidence in favor of the verdict. We assume that, and because we know the jury believed the state's evidence, and the state's evidence was that the washing of her hair after having had any last physical contact would have gotten rid of any significant quantities of DNA. And our expert says that when she washed her hair, any significant quantities of DNA from casual contact would have been.
Didn't the state also argue in its final argument that, in fact, he was the only one who could have killed her, and but there had been an exclusion under the direct connection,
yes, sir,
premise of evidence relating to somebody named Lambert Anthony Feldman, who had some fingerprint evidence on her car and apparently a shotgun in his possession, or at least in his life, because he took his own life with a shotgun. The question I have is both really related to the direct connection standard, but also whether you can exclude evidence and then come back and argue, well, there wasn't any such thing.
Well, and I think there's an important distinction to make. I didn't, when the evidence of Anthony Feldman was excluded, I didn't argue where fingerprints. That would be improper. I agree with you, Judge. You can't exclude evidence and then argue where's that evidence. That's not fair. What I did argue was the evidence in the case. And the evidence, Mr. Nash's expert comes in and says, you get it under the fingernails by casual contact. My argument is logical, I think, and I think it's understood by the jury, is, okay, if that's casual contact, then we know the guy who did kill Judy Spencer, if it wasn't Mr. Nash, did a lot more than have casual contact. So where's his evidence? Why isn't there a third person? If his is by casual contact, then where's the evidence? Now, Mr. Nash says that's not fair. I believe that is a fair comment on the evidence. I think it's directly related to the evidence that was admitted at court. So I don't think that it was cheating or being unfair in any way. With regard to the exclusion of evidence, and I think I want to make this clear to the court as well, that the fourth point in the brief, Mr. Nash is not arguing that the trial court abused its discretion in excluding this under the direct connection rule. What he's arguing, the only argument he makes, is that the direct evidence rule is unconstitutional. And I think that issue has been decided by the United States Supreme Court and by this court. The United States Supreme Court in Holmes versus South Carolina, which is the case that Mr. Nash cites positively this court's decision in State versus Cheney, which upheld the direct connection rule. Okay. So
was this constitutional question raised below?
He said it's a violation of the constitutional rights, and he said under the 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, and 9th Amendment. That, I'm going to leave it to the courts. You'll decide whether or not that's a sufficient preservation or not. I don't think that really puts the court on fair notice, and I think the law is well established that when you make a constitutional challenge, that you, in fairness to the trial court, you need to give them the first opportunity by specifying what it is, and simply saying that's a violation of the Constitution doesn't do it. But again, I think the court will decide it. The other thing, and the reason I think that he doesn't come into this court and actually argue an abuse of discretion by the trial court, is because the trial court, in fairness, could not have done anything else. There are three different versions of the offer of proof. There's one at the pretrial, then there's the second one was made while the jury was deliberating. And it's kind of hard for the trial court to do anything at that point. The other big problem with it is to make an offer of proof, to be able to preserve an allegation that evidence was improperly excluded, it has to be specific, and you have to establish the admissibility of it. It was in no way specific. This fingerprint by Mr. Feldman. Now, first of all, we know that Mr. Feldman worked in a gas station, and so there may have been an innocent explanation. The other thing is that I by no means concede that there was this narrow window in which Ms. Spencer had to have been killed. Mr. Nash says has to have been at 9:10 or 9:15 a.m. on March 11th, 1982. That's simply not true. That's simply not supported by the evidence, and it's speculation. The car was there for at least 14 hours after it was first seen abandoned. It was seen at 7:30 in the morning by Mr. Cowan. He then called the police at 9:30 in the evening. Mr. Cowan looked at the car, looked around it. So the fact that Mr. Feldman's fingerprint, and by the way, in the offer proof, we don't know who lifted the fingerprint. we have absolutely, and I say we, the trial court, because again, we have to be fair to the, to him, wasn't told, where's this fingerprint? Now, if a fingerprint is on the car door handle, that's a little more different than if it's found on the hood or the trunk. But the offer of proof is insufficient because it doesn't tell us where it is. If we're talking about a finger, we're talking about a thumb, we're talking about a hand, all that kind of information. The same thing with the other allegations that were raised. It was nonspecific. We don't even know the police officers that Mr. Feldman supposedly said I'd never seen Judy Spencer. Now, we don't know, did they ask Judy Spencer? Did they mention her name? Did they show him a picture? All of that is unclear. And so I think it is fundamentally unfair to argue, and that's why I think he's not arguing, that somehow the trial court committed reversible error and abused its discretion in not allowing the testimony of Mr. Feldman, because there wasn't a sufficient record. But the issue before the court is it constitutional? And I don't think there's any question at all that this court has repeatedly and properly said that the focus of the jury should be on, does the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Nash committed this murder? It's not a multiple choice test. It's not, you know, let's make a deal. We've got three different doors. It's this. And anything that distracts the jury from making that important decision is prejudicial. And it becomes more prejudicial when the quantum of evidence is less and when it is speculative. I didn't address the first claim by Mr. Nash because I think it's pretty self-evident that 565.001 allows us to relate back our case to 1982. If there are no questions, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Counsel misstates the evidence. All of the evidence was that the date and time of death was March 11, 1982, at approximately 9 o'clock in the morning. There was no evidence whatsoever. The state's own pathologist wrote a report saying so. The state's own coroner wrote a report saying so. That is all of the evidence as to date and time of death. The state misstates that we offered a shifting offer of proof as to the Anthony Lambert Feldman third-party guilt evidence, and that what was presented in response to the state's motion to exclude that evidence was something different than the offer of proof stated at trial. I'll cite the court to page 921 of the transcript. In the tail end of defendant's offer of proof, the trial judge said, "I've heard this argument before, just not on the record." There's no change. The state keeps saying without support that the circumstantial evidence rule wasn't a different standard, wasn't a different rule than the simple beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Then the Cheney case wouldn't exist. The Cheney case came up with the opinion in Cheney was that reversal would have been mandated for Mr. Cheney if the circumstantial evidence rule had been applied. This court in the Southern District came up with diametrically opposite results in Freeman, where the...
Are you saying this court can't change any evidence rule or just this one because you think it's related to proof beyond a reasonable doubt? So if we allowed in certain kinds of original evidence, and then did not allow in certain kinds of copies, say at that time, and then changed the rule to let in copies, would we have to apply the pre-84 rule on copies and any other kind of evidence rule too?
Well, I can't speak specifically to the issue of copies.
But think about
the new rule reduces the quantum of proof
on anything, changes, makes it easier to prove. I mean, reduces the quantum is if it changes the way you prove.
If it becomes easier for the state to convict under the new rule, it can't be retroactively applied. The state has argued.
Won't that depend on case by case what kind of evidence defense happens to put in the state happens to put in?
It may.
And the better
procedure with the direct evidence rule would be that it's simply argued by the state. This is speculative. This is merely conclusory. Just the way I had to argue, the state's case was speculative. The state's case was merely conclusory. The jury can understand it when I argue the weakness of the state's evidence, but under the direct connection rule, the jury's incompetent to hear the state make the same argument. I want to point out that we never argued that this DNA was present by virtue of casual contact. And I discussed it at some length in my reply brief. It's not in the transcript. It was never argued. The state's expert didn't testify that this couldn't happen from casual contact. The state's expert testified that this could not be non-contact DNA. The state misstates the evidence when it says we presented no hand-washing study. One study we presented was specifically a hand-washing study where a male nurse was alleged to have digitally penetrated a patient, scrubbed his hands in a hospital setting repeatedly for 2 weeks, and yet still had her DNA under his fingernails. That's a hand-washing study. The state says that it did not argue.
Any further questions? Thank you. Your time is fine. Case is taken under submission.